Welcome to Hackhead, the Internet of Hackable Things with Kirk Jackson, Felix Shi, and Andy the Piker Prow. So Andy sadly couldn't be with us today. He is dead or soon to be. And so it's just me and Felix today. We both work at Xero on the product security team. Unfortunately, Felix has the lucky position of being under me at work in the org structure, which means that unfortunately I'm now a manager. So introduce yourself, Felix.
G'day everyone, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Felix Shi and I started working at Xero last year. As you can see, I do believe that Andy Prow couldn't make it today, being a CEO of a highly important company. Surely he's got more important things to do. At least that's what we assume.
What an expletive. Cool. So today we're going to talk about the Internet of Things.
So what exactly is the Internet of Things? I mean, you see that word being thrown around everywhere. These days you can just put smart in front of any noun to make it an Internet of Things. You have fridge, smart fridge, toaster, smart toaster, watch, smart watch. Hell, these days you can even put smart in front of a trash can. A few days ago I saw it in a Twitter post, there is now a smart trash can that can kernel panic. So there we go. These days, anything can have network connectivity, allowing them to send and receive data, but let's not get hung up on the definitions right now. And in the last few years, there's been a growth in the Internet of Things, for example. Have a look.
Yeah, so I mean, you hear a lot about Internet of Things here at the conference this week, since there's a whole stream or topic on it. But as you can see, you know, personal computers kind of growing slowly, but the Internet of Things growth is enormous. There'll be billions of devices connected within the next 5 or 10 years. And as you can see by the shape of the curve, within about 50 years, we'll approach the number of atoms in the universe connected to our internet, which means that we're going to have to switch from IPv4 to IPv6.
Well, it's about time.
So here's a view of my hometown. This was the view when I was doing my research at university. I'd walk to the top of the stairs and look out at Wellington and think about what I'd done wrong in my life.
Scary enough, we went to the same university and we looked the same view. Wellington hasn't changed.
Yes.
Not at
all. 5 or 10 years different. So where would you find things connected to the internet in Wellington? Well, we've seen printers before. Printers have been connected to local networks pretty much forever. You know, gone are the days when you have to have one of those parallel port switches to take turns printing in the office. But now printers are cloud enabled, like the Google Cloud Print service lets you print from your browser and your printer will pick up the job from Google and print it remotely.
So you can in fact print off your 30-page thesis before you leave home, go to university, take it off, and then head home. There we go, no longer have to wait. And then we have smart meter. These days, for example, you can now actually check how much power you've used using the magical mobile phone, as opposed to actually asking the meter man to read it every time. What's the next item?
Parking meters. So these have been connected to the internet for ages. You've been able to pay via text message. They've got, you know, SIM cards inside them. Traffic signals. That would be a really fun prank to play. I'm sure no one's ever done that in a movie. And, you know, there's cameras everywhere connected to the grid.
Of course, and there's always one mighty important person staring at a panel of screens, probably falling asleep.
Well, in Wellington, we can't afford that, so we actually ask people in the community to spy on other people by camera.
Oh, but of course. Cars.
Why would you connect your car to the internet?
We have smart cars in Wellington.
Oh, I guess it sort of complements the politicians.
I guess.
Washing machines. So here's a university flat with a washing machine, but this is not the typical student. They've bought a brand new washing machine rather than stealing one. And their one can connect to the internet and they can control it via the iPhone.
Snazzy. Heat pumps. Now you can actually control your heat pump, say, on your phone. Let's say if you're leaving the home, you can just turn the heat pump off. When you get back, turn it on. Everything will be nice and warm.
Yeah, and I pointed that towards sort of Mount Vic, Oriental Bay.
The rich people area.
The rich people, yeah.
People with too much money and too little common sense. Apologies to anyone from Oriental Bay.
No apologies. So, internet-connected fridges. So we'll talk about one of these in a little while. But, you know, your fridge sits in your kitchen all day long on its own. It needs someone to talk to.
I might get lonely. I can't talk to the dryer. The dryer's not exactly the smartest device. We haven't invented smart dryers yet.
Fitbits. So, the pretentious hipsters in Wellington run along Oriental Parade calculating their, mean time between steps or how excited they are or whatever they do with their connected devices that publish their data to the cloud so that their other hipster friends can look at them.
Social running. Instead of running in a group, you can run along and still feel social.
We've got light bulbs in Newtown and those scungy student flats. We've got tourists on Mountain Vic, all connected to each other and connected back home. And we've even got the internet connected to the planes that we fly in the sky. This is not a concern at all.
Not one bit.
So, quick raise of hands. How many hipsters in the room have one of these in their house? Yay. You guys win the award. There's a prize. There's not really. You're just hipsters. You don't need prizes. You're cool anyway.
You used the Internet of Things before it was cool, okay? There we go.
So we did. Disposable income for the win. Here's a survey that someone did in Austin, Texas. They flew a drone over their neighborhood and tracked Zigbee devices. So Zigbee's like a mesh networking protocol. They flew over the neighborhood, tracked the devices, plotted it all on a map. You can zoom in and zoom out over the city, look for devices of different types, whether they're lighting or other things, and then drill into the street address of those people.
Yeah, not creepy at all.
Not creepy at all. We would never do that.
Yeah, we have a pretty good track record when it comes to internet, right? I mean, think about it. We have a lot of internet-connected devices before the Internet of Things was cool. For example, home internet routers. I mean, nothing's wrong with internet routers, right? For example, like, have a look. Oh, what is this? Millions of router vulnerable to attack? Routers hacked? Travesty. Now, when you think about it, routers, they're not too indifferent from your smartwatch or your smartphones. Are they internet connected? Yes. Do they sit at home? Yes. And do they have a piece of firmware inside that is notoriously difficult to upgrade? I mean, a raise of hand to, has anyone actually upgraded their router firmware here? All right, that's the wrong crowd. Okay, now imagine this. Let's say, for example, your uncle or your auntie or your grandfather, you set up their router, everything is good, and then 3 years later, they're probably still running version 1.2 alpha.
People just treat these as appliances. They go down to Dick Smith, they buy one, they stick it under the sofa, and the only time they ever look at it is when the cat pees on it. You know, no one ever updates their routers, and I was not expecting that many people to raise their hands.
Next slide. Yep.
So there's a website that catalogs. You can go by make, model, look at all the problems with your routers.
For educational purposes
only. For educational purposes. I've got the link in the slides, routerpwn.com. It's basically just these consumer devices shipped out. No one ever looks at them again. If the manufacturers want to fix security vulnerabilities in the router, they have no way of doing it.
So it's actually up to the customer to actually upgrade the router firmware or change the default credentials. I mean, you will be surprised how many routers actually have admin as the default credential. Not that I know, but continue.
Okay, so Andy, your turn to talk about the Android ecosystem.
Sounds right.
Oh, Andy's not here. Okay, so the Android ecosystem is kind of a cluster. Android phones, a lot of them are running 2-point-something version of Android, early 4 versions, and they're sitting in people's pockets all around the world, unpatched and unable to be patched. And security issues keep popping up on Android phones, and there is no way to get fixes to the users. So I think the recent one was a MMS, picture message, vulnerability in Android. But, there's been tons of them in the past, and the Android ecosystem relies on Google fixing the patch, pushing it to the device manufacturer, say Samsung. Samsung fixing it in their firmware, pushing the patch to the telco. The telco adding all that crap stuff they put onto it to make the phone unusable, and then possibly releasing it to the end user's devices over the air.
Possibly.
Very, very unlikely. And so these things tend not to get patched. So do we have a good track record, Felix?
Well, you look at it. No, not really, do we?
So, Internet of Things, we're going to do this better. We've been putting things on the internet for close on 3 years now, We should be really good at this. So here's a standard Internet of Things device.
Hello, I'm a teddy bear.
This is a Toyfy teddy, so it's not a particularly sophisticated device. You can take it to bed at night and cuddle it. I don't know if you could hear him.
Let's try it. Come on, Teddy.
The sound comes out of his butt. Anyway, this teddy bear lets me record messages, send them using my mobile phone to the cloud, running on a server at pars.com. They will store the audio of these messages in the cloud in some storage environment. And then when my kids are at home with the teddies, assuming I didn't take it away with me at a conference, they can do this simple, quite cumbersome step of like syncing, downloading, and listening to the audio on the device. And my mobile device talks to the teddy over Bluetooth Low Energy, and it also talks to AWS and pars.com. Cool, so that's our typical kind of looking Internet of Things setup. So we made a picture to represent the typical Internet of Things stack.
Yep, thank you, Kirk. So for example, let's have a look. Imagine that is not a teddy bear, just any other generic, let's say, smart device. I like that word, smart. Everything is smart these days, except for the people, or me. So what we have here is we have the device, for example, teddy bear. And normally the teddy bear communicates to a server on the internet. Well, that's putting the internet in the Internet of Things, of course. It can either talk to the server directly or talk to the server via an intermediary device, for example, an app on the mobile phone, for example, via either, say, TCP/IP, Bluetooth, or some other kind of protocol. And once it's been sent to the server will process the data, store it in the back end in the magical cloud environment, and then send it back to the device.
Cool, so what are little Internet of Things normally made from? Well, us hobbyists normally make them by stringing together Arduinos and various boards that we clip into them. What do we call those?
Raspberry Pi, or just
Or Raspberry Pis.
Yeah, or
but when you want to go like hardcore, you actually end up building your own embedded controller and shipping it out because, you know, like a Raspberry Pi is too expensive and the Chinese controller that you can buy is probably, you know, 50 cents.
Probably a lot cheaper, but...
Yeah. They'll typically have a network adapter, they'll typically have local storage, and if it's a teddy bear, it'll probably have some honey inside.
And that's how you get ants. All right, the cloud. Well, if the teddy bear has to send information somewhere, it's got to live in the cloud. I mean, the cloud is not too different from your standard web app. You have your APIs, they can come in different flavors, REST, SOAP, what's not, and the data has to be stored somewhere. We just don't know where, unless you actually sniff the traffic, but we'll get to that.
And then there's the phone. So we've been building phone apps probably for almost as long as we've been building web apps, just to say about 3 years. And that's the interface to the actual user for most of these devices. Sometimes it's a laptop app. But you know, there's a locally installed app. It collects the data, it displays reports, it does graphs, you know, all the kind of boring stuff.
Actually, speaking of which, the phone, have you seen the Amazon button? It's like a button you just press. It's like the epitome of laziness. It is amazing.
Okay, that's the Amazon Dash.
That is the Amazon
Dash. You can stick a button on your washing machine that says, like, Persil, and every time you run out of Persil, you push the button and Amazon will send it to your house.
Yep.
It's a button per device, per product you want to buy. Cool, and then the thing that glues them together is the network. And Internet of Things devices tend to have quite a lot of different options for communicating. So this is from a Postscapes study, the link's in the notes. So the things that we normally deal with when we're building web apps or other apps in our network environment is, you know, TCP/IP over and Ethernet or Wi-Fi. But there's a lot of other networking protocols that you'll see from the physical, you know, like scanning an RFID tag or plugging into a power line, to the very close, like NFC, RFID, the ANT protocol, slightly further away, like Zigbee and Bluetooth, to the long distance protocols. So, you know, the cell phone networks, the satellite networks, the interstellar network. And there's a bunch of different protocols that connect all these things together. And your Internet of Things device, when you're choosing which network protocol to use, you'll be trading off battery power versus, you know, range versus security to make the decision of which networking protocol is the right one to pick.
Yep, and now we talked about the Internet of Things, now let's talk about the Internet of Hackable Things. The things we hacked, the things other people have hacked, and generally things that are just amusing to look at.
Let's start off with my teddy bear. Purchased for $30 in a remainder sale. I can't imagine why they would want to knock the price down of this lovely cuddly teddy bear that tells me it loves me every time I press the button. It's got an iPhone app, which you can record messages, send them to loved ones over the internet. The teddy bear syncs with the app and connects and downloads the messages. And this is the picture I showed earlier of how it works. Pars.com appears to be the third party that collects all my data. What my phone does is it actually asks Pars.com for a URL to post the data to and posts the WAV files up to AWS, where they're stored unencrypted and visible on the internet. So probably want to just be careful not to get too explicit in your teddy bear greetings.
And then what
the app does after it puts the file on AWS is then it tells Pars.com, oh, here's where I put the file. So the nice thing about this was that you can just put any files you want on AWS and not bother telling the third party that you've put them there. And you can just use it as free storage.
But why would you do that? I mean, you are nice people with happy feelings, right? I mean, really, you wouldn't take advantage of this poor, cuddly, lovable teddy bear. Oh,
yeah.
Unless you're Kirk.
I have not taken advantage of that teddy bear.
Yet.
That wasn't in the script. And the actual protocol that the device talks to and from the phone is Bluetooth Low Energy, which is like a cut-down version of Bluetooth that uses less battery and to boot has slightly weaker encryption, so it's a little bit easier to break into if you need to. And the teddy bear exposes some things over Bluetooth that you can fiddle around with off-the-shelf downloadable Bluetooth fiddling tools. So problems with the teddy. So the mobile app was SSL but not pinned, which means that I could use my friendly Wi-Fi access point that proxies all the traffic through my laptop and watch the traffic as it was going by to see how it talks to the API. The audio files, as I said, are visible on the cloud. There is a GUID in them, so it's unlikely someone else will find the dodgy files, but you can put whatever you want there. And the app allows you to sign up with a really weak password, doesn't let you change it, and when you invite your friends to send messages to the teddy bear, it sends them over email your username and your password and tells them to log in as you to send messages.
And now who thought that was a good idea? Well, the teddy bear, of course.
Yeah. Stop picking on the teddy bear. So it ticks up a bunch of our boxes of flaws. Another one is that you can send emails from anyone to anyone using their service because they don't actually check. So you can just use this app as a mail server. And it's kind of creepy. Like, you have this thing sitting in a bedroom recording and playing stuff that it just gets off the internet. It's kind of creepy.
That is, actually, when you think about it.
So buggy web app, login flaws, network flaws. The cloud service is a bit dodgy. The mobile app is a bit dodgy. And it ticks all our creepy bells.
It's kind of creepy, isn't it?
That's a really weird mixed metaphor. Don't tick bells. So we stole this grid approach from Karina, who spoke at WDCNZ. Her talk was on
algorithms, I believe.
Yeah, insightful algorithms. If you're interested in data and the bad things that can happen with it, I recommend you go to the WDCNZ and watch her talk. It was really mind-blowing. And she also used a bingo board kind of approach, although she had different categories in hers. So there's an example of me sending messages to Felix, telling him I love him, just from any email address to any other email address.
Yeah, and that was kind of creepy at all. I think that ticked my creepy box. So one night, just received an email from Kirk saying, unrequited love. Oh, dear. All right, light bulbs. Let's talk about light bulbs. LifeX, just a disclaimer, we did not perform this hack. We actually saw someone else doing it. So, LifeX light bulb. It is Okay, who thought it's a good idea to put Wi-Fi inside a light bulb, a Wi-Fi-enabled light bulb that you can control remotely from your mobile device? Well, obviously a lot of people, since this started off as a Kickstarter project 3 years ago or so, correct me if I'm wrong, and they received 13 times the amount of funding they originally asked for. So obviously a lot of lazy people who want to sit on the couch, watch TV, and think, the light switch is just a bit too far away. Let me get my phone out.
Stop hassling me, skinny man.
Hey, I'll hassle you all I want.
The app that I was just playing with is the app on your iPhone. So you can choose colors, you can have themes, do smart effects like strobe, beat to the music. It's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. So how does it work? So for example, you have your mobile phone, which controls the intensity, density, and color of the light. Go, hit it, Kirk. Do it.
I think it's already doing stuff.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. And both the light bulb and the light bulb's controller talk to your Wi-Fi router, and that is where it receives the commands from. As you can see on the left-hand side, you might be wondering what the smaller light bulbs are. The creator of LifeX light bulb has done something very, very interesting. If you have multiple light bulbs, not all of them will be connected to your Wi-Fi router. In fact, only one of them will, by the original design specs. They actually use a mesh network, so they actually designate which one is the master light bulb and all the other ones are less important light bulbs because, you know, we're in the 21st century and slavery is abolished, hopefully.
We're not in America. You can say slave.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Slave light bulbs then. And should something unfortunate happen to the master light bulb, let's say a mutiny of some sort, a new master will be elected. You know, that's just how society works.
It's kind of like politics.
It kind of is, isn't it? Vultures everywhere.
And the light bulbs talk UDP over the network and basically broadcast their current settings and listen for commands.
They do indeed.
And there's no encryption of that traffic. I mean, it's by design, but if I'm on the network, I can start a web server. I actually need to stop the show for a sec.
Show must stop.
Sorry, this is really slow every time I turn that off. So this is just a simple little node, it's not actually that simple, a web server that someone wrote. What they did is they took apart the protocols of all the UDP packets that these light bulbs send to each other. Well, actually they didn't get all of them, but they took apart many of them.
Most of them.
And then provided a web app and a command line app that you can use. And so your computer can just send these packets over the internet, and presumably the light bulb is currently changing color.
Is that changing color?
See, it's pretty awesome.
Smart, right?
Cool. And there's command line interfaces. Cool. So I'll let you keep talking while I laboriously make this.
Fair enough. Continue. Right. Light bulb. So it's a light bulb. What could possibly go wrong? Let's have a look. You know, yes, it is a light bulb. Light bulbs communicate with each other via mesh network, and it talks. As Kirk said, most of it is unencrypted, but one part is, and that is your home Wi-Fi password, and that is stored in an encrypted blob, and that is being transmitted between the light bulbs. It's quite interesting, really. So how the people in the States, some smart cookie in the States, managed to hack it? Do I have their names here? No, I don't. If you're here in the crowd, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, whoever done this.
We've got the link in our notes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yep.
So the communication, they managed to actually take the light bulb, reverse engineer it. By reverse engineering, I mean taking a hammer to it, beating it to bits, take out the internal firmware, wire up a whole lot of specialized reverse engineering, both hardware and software to it, to actually obtain the encryption key from the firmware itself. So with the encryption key in hand, they can actually decrypt the encrypted blob that's being transmitted between the light bulbs. So all of a sudden, they can actually pretend to be a light bulb. Like they get the computer, set everything up, and says, hey, master light bulb, I'm actually a fellow slave light bulb. Please allow me to give me your Wi-Fi password and let me bask in your glory. And the master light bulb would say, oh, sure thing, mate. Just have the password.
And, yeah. And so they use the same encryption key on every light bulb.
They have used the same encryption
which key. Which means that these guys reversed one, they can decrypt any of the UDP packets that have Wi-Fi passwords anywhere in the world. And they don't actually have to connect to your home Wi-Fi network, because the master light bulb does that. They just need to connect to the slave network, the mesh network, which is this 6 LoWPAN networking protocol.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, when people think about this kind of stuff, it's like, well, whoop-de-doo, it is just another Internet of Things device hacked. I'd like to bring you to the attention of that it is actually quite difficult to hack some of those devices. For example, with this, you actually need to take the thing apart, have specialized hardware to perform the reverse engineering required in order to retrieve the encryption key. So a lot of times, it's not as easy as it sounds, and it's not so much like in the newspaper, you see, things are insecure, but insecure against what? Against a determined, persistent attacker? I mean, that is a bar a lot of us are having trouble clearing.
Yes, but it only takes one person to do it. And what Lithix had to do then was issue new firmware for the bulbs. And I think they've actually turned off the mesh network, so now every bulb connects individually to the Wi-Fi network, just because it's easier to secure that way. So the problems that we saw there, there was communication going in the clear, so those UDP packets you can read and watch, so you can see if someone's in their bedroom with the lights down low.
That's kind of creepy.
The networking obviously was flawed. The device stores the Wi-Fi credentials in it and gives it back to you, so it has secrets. And of course, it's hardware, so it's hackable.
In that case, wouldn't you say every hardware is hackable?
Pretty much, but this is an example of where they actually did hack the hardware.
That is true.
Yeah. So here's another gadget that hipsters like. So I spent $1,000 on my iPhone, but I still can't sleep at night. And so I want to get some insights into why this is. So this company somewhere in the world laboriously and very well documented made this device, which is like a piece of plastic with a nice covering over it and LEDs that spin around. And I put that next to my bed at night and I clip a little sensor on my pillow. And this device tracks my movement during the night. It tracks the temperature in the room, the humidity, the light levels, so how bright or dark the light is. And it also tracks any noises that happen in the room during the night. And it gives you a score at the end saying how well you're sleeping effectively. And so there's, where is it? There. So there's an iPhone app, which is all washed out because it's for hipsters, which gives you a score. You can scroll through the app and see which parts of the night you're in deep sleep. I mean, you've seen this crap before, right? It's Internet of Me or whatever we call it. The one that sort of popped out to me was, so it measures humidity. I'm not that worried if someone finds out how humid my bedroom is.
Hopefully not.
But noise?
Really? The truck is the truck.
Yeah, so you know if a truck's driving past in the night, and the vision for it is that it will play the sounds that woke you up. They haven't actually released that feature yet, probably because it's extremely creepy.
What if you sleep, for example? What if, like, you know, while you're sleeping, you say, you begin to pray to some elderly, some kind of cosmic god out there?
Wow. Okay.
Okay.
Now I know what concerns you. So how this works is the initial setup's over Bluetooth. The device itself connects to the Wi-Fi network once you set it up, stores the username and password, and then it connects out to the cloud using SSL. And that communication I couldn't break into. They were using SSL. They were checking the certificate. And short of actually pulling apart this device, which cost a lot of money I didn't want to do, I couldn't figure out how to break that communication. But the mobile phone app that retrieves the data and can look at it, that network can be intercepted. If you own the mobile phone device, you can look at your own traffic, is what I'm saying. So the problems with it, it's mostly actually reasonably good, that device. The attack surface is very low, nothing is exposed to the network. It talks securely to the cloud. The thing that's wrong with it is kind of that it's creepy. And, you know, it's the sort of thing where, you know, coupled with a teddy bear that's recording noises and this that's recording noises, people could figure out when you're at home and what you're doing in your bedroom. And there's obviously privacy concerns because, you know, all this data about you is sitting in a cloud service and, you know, now you're vulnerable to any attack against that service.
Yep. Moving along. What is everyone looking at here? SD card. Everyone's seen an SD card before. SD card, when you plug it in, it actually runs a DNS server, strangely enough, and it runs a web server. Now, who thought that was a good idea? I mean, when I first saw this, I'm like, why? Why do we need to run a web server and a file server on an SD card? So it turns out you can actually put it in your digital camera. and access it from your laptop. So when you plug it in, when it receives power, it will start as on DNS server, and it acts as if it's a router. By default, it sets up an access point, but you can configure it to proxy your home internet connection through this little thing here.
So what you can do is you can plug it into your laptop, then you can connect to the SD card as your access point, and then it connects to your home network, and then all your traffic goes through the SD card in a slot in your computer to your home network.
Now, why would you want to do that?
The thing that I think is really interesting about this is, like, I didn't realize until a year or so ago that SD cards had microcontrollers on them. So flash storage is apparently really unreliable, so there's actually a computer inside managing which bits get written to and writing off, like, corrupt parts. It's cheaper than apparently producing good flash storage. So the normal SD card has a computer in it, but this one actually has an ARM processor in it with
Indeed
a network stack, a small web server and DNS server, Wi-Fi access point.
And apparently it runs NetBIOS as well.
Yeah, all running on that little tiny device. It's kind of crazy.
It kind of is. So, by this diagram, I've divided the SD card into two separate parts. So you have the file storage, the traditional, you know, just traditional use case for an SD card. You put things on it. You normally don't use an SD card for a wireless access point. And let's say you have a camera, digital camera. You can begin taking photos and retrieve the photos from your phone. Let's say if you have a small SD card, I would hardly call 32 gigs small. You can actually delete the files remotely if the, you know, if you can't get hold.
I mean,
it gets full, yeah.
Yeah, I think those old photos actually had quite a few pixels in them, so they take up a lot of space.
Yep. That's a lot of pixels.
What, 3 centipixels?
Who knows? And also it's black and white as well.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Cool, so the problems that we saw with this?
So the problem we saw with this, I did a lot of the testing on this so far. The internet-facing side is actually quite good, only 53 UDP. Port, which is the DNS port, and 80 HTTP ports open. That is all good. It still baffles me how they managed to run an operating system inside an SD card, you know, inside my computer. The only problem with this is that we discovered that all the default credentials for every single SD card is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, despite the fact that it is easily changeable and they recommend you to change it. We strongly doubt that, let's say, some less informed individuals.
Well, we didn't change it, well, so why would anyone else change
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Are you implying that we're less informed? Well, I'm informed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all communication happened via plain text HTTP. So, and what's interesting about this is that if you want to access the administrative panel of the web interface, it requires a so-called master code. But the master code just happens to be the MAC address of the first device that was used to run and set up the SD card. So often, if we know which device used the SD card, we know the administrative password. And it is actually awfully difficult to change that master code. To date, I still have no idea how to change it. So if anyone knows how to change the master code on this thing, just give me a yell afterwards, because it is awfully unintuitive.
So we'll switch to a demo of that, I guess, at the end and show what else you can do with that device. But login flaws, communications in plain text, and kind of bad defaults. Sweet. Next up is the cars. So hands up if you actually saw this in the news. Yeah, sweet. So this kind of got mainstream attention. So Charlie Miller and Chris Valasich, I think they've been doing car hacking for 3 or 4 years. I think we've talked about it, me and the soon-to-be deceased Andy Prow. We've talked about it at TechEd before. They took it to the next level and sent a reporter hurtling down a highway, and while they were talking to him on the phone, they said, hey, look what we can do to you. And he ended up in a ditch. And people were kind of up in arms because they thought, you shouldn't do that sort of thing on highways, like drunk people never drive.
Yep.
And got all upset. So what actually happened? So it turns out in Jeep Cherokees, and probably in a lot of cars, including probably Nigel's new car that he was telling me about the other night, they have this thing called the CAN bus, which sits inside the car and controls the communication between the tens of computers that are inside your car. So there's, you know, most modern cars don't actually have, you know, like pneumatics or wires connecting stuff. The brake pedal is just a switch, and the brakes are a machine that turns on when the switch is pressed. And so that would be something sitting on the CAN bus, the engine control system, the thermostat, the air conditioning. all sitting off this bus as separate devices that communicate. And the CAN bus is reasonably well documented. It just trusts everything that it receives and does what it's told, so there's no encryption on that network. Because you need physical access to a car to plug something into it. So, if you're actually in the car, the car kind of trusts you to do what you tell it. So Cherokee stuck a CD player in it that does internet stuff. Apparently it's an upgrade on the tape deck in my Jap import. This actually has a GPRS or mobile protocol, what do you call it? This has a SIM card in it, which connects to the internet, connects to the AT&T network, can do web stuff over the network. Turn out that if you were an AT&T customer, like Charlie and Chris were, you could just scan all other AT&T customers and look for open ports on the head units and tell them stuff because the head units were exposed without basically a firewall in front of them. So what their attack did was they scanned the network, found the IP address of the head unit they wanted to target, exploited the head unit software, which had some bugs in it that caused memory corruption, uploaded their own firmware, and reflashed the firmware of the head unit, and then allowed it to proxy commands through to the CAN bus and turn on the wipers, turn on the brakes, while the car was traveling at 100k an hour.
How terrifying.
Which is kind of terrifying. So Cherokee issued a recall / firmware update for their head units, and AT&T blocked the network traffic between cars, which seemed like a good thing to block to start with, actually.
Why do cars need to talk to each other anyway? I mean, we're not in that Pixar movie.
Yeah. that Pixar movie in the keynote was so lovely.
It is, isn't it?
So networking flaws, the CAN bus is in the clear, so anyone can put commands on it. The device that was running the code connected to the internet had bugs in it. Mm. And of course, like, the car's sitting in the garage of a security researcher, and he's like, I just dropped 60K on this thing. I want to figure out how it works. So, the hardware is hackable, and they did pull it apart.
Yep. When you think about it, you have an insecure car. Great. Time to get insurance. Nothing bad will happen from there on. Let's get insurance so if someone does manage to hack my car, I can get some money back. Intermetro Mile Pulse. It is a pay-per-mile insurance. Pretty much, they charge your insurance based on how much you drive. It is a dongle, pretty much like a little dongle thing you plug into your dashboard. What is that? You notice that it is a mobile device dongle that receives command from SMS, and it talks back to the Metro Pulse cloud service, and it also have direct access to the CAN bus Kirk was talking about earlier. And turns out some researchers from the University of California, Professor Stephen Savage, I believe, discovered that there's actually the root credential on every device is identical, and it receives and acts upon when it receives an SMS message. So in fact, you can text your car and tell it to stop, or in fact, engage the windscreen wipers. I mean, engaging windscreen wipers is one thing, but engaging the brake, I think that's kind of scary. And plus, I think it's just the terminology, getting hacked through your dongle just sounds terrifying.
But
it does. No, seriously.
We should have ticked the creepy tag on that one. In their defense, Metro Mile said, the phone numbers of the devices are a secret.
Mm.
So, no one's ever sent SMS spam to anyone else.
Oh, hopefully not.
Here's another one. This one's got audio, so we'll see how that goes. It's going pretty good.
Yep. So.
Okay, it sounds like that's going to go now.
TP750 rifle.
The TP750 is a computer-assisted, self-aiming, long-range sniper rifle. Its targeting system guarantees almost foolproof accuracy by firing not when the shooter first pulls the trigger, but instead only after the barrel is perfectly lined up with the target.
So when I push the red button that's right above the trigger, the crosshairs turn blue so that I can line up exactly where I want to hit. When I let the red button go, the blue crosshairs will turn red, and when I then pull the trigger, The crosshairs turn red, and the scope will fire when I manage to line up the shot.
The $13,000 rifle promises accuracy to even the most novice shooters. But security researchers Runa Sandvik and her husband, Michael Auger, have found ways to hack the gun via its Wi-Fi connection.
We found that we could make the shooter miss the shot, either by just a tiny bit or completely off, even to the point of hitting the target that's next to the one that the shooter is aiming for.
Tracking point rifles offer a Wi-Fi connection that allows a nearby computer to stream the video from the scope or even change settings like wind, temperature, and ammunition weight.
We found a way to connect directly to the computer that's inside of it and change the same values, but in such a way that it doesn't show up in the screen.
How terrifying is that? I was actually completely creeped out the whole time we were preparing these slides and basically swearing at Americans under my breath the whole time. Like, why would you...
Why would you enable Wi-Fi in this thing?
So here's their marketing site. Some call it Evolution. They call it Dominion.
Herd management?
And the good thing is it's a highly efficient tool for culling and managing populations of whitetail, elk, and other species.
Is that what they call the armies these days?
That's what they call the army these days.
Oh, okay.
Freaky. So here's what happens. There's a Wi-Fi connection on your gun. You can stream the video from the scope to your iPad so people at home can track your progress as you butcher innocent animals.
Animals, of course.
And it receives commands over Wi-Fi, because why wouldn't you? And it's for novices, so you're waving a gun around like this, and it will fire the bullet at the right time when you're lined up with your target. Nice. At least in the old days, terrorists had to learn how to shoot.
We'll have some skill.
So what problems are there with the gun?
Yeah. Moving along.
So all the problems are wrong with that gun. Next up, the fridge.
Let's talk about a fridge, something nice. For example, fridge. You have a fridge at home. We all have a fridge at home. But who actually have a fridge that have built-in internal speakers that can stream music, download apps, or, you know, check your Google Calendar? I mean, it has never occurred to me why your fridge need to be a music player. And looking at the specs of the fridge...
Oh, you can sync, you can Bluetooth connect it to your phone
you can.
So that you can talk to people on the fridge while your phone is in your pocket.
Why? Why, seriously?
Oh, and the reason I know this is because the manual for this fridge was 120 pages.
I was like,
this kind of blew my mind that a manual for a fridge was 120 pages. 70 pages of the manual were how to use the LCD touchscreen on the fridge. And the last page of those 70 pages was how to set up Wi-Fi. So I was just imagining someone getting this fridge delivered to their house, going, damn it, the map's not working. Try the next one. I can't play Pandora. Get to the last one. Oh, Wi-Fi. That's what I need.
Wait. So if it is in a 120-page manual and 70 of them are for the touch panel, why do you need 50 pages for a fridge?
There's one page on how to open the door. Another one how to close the door. I don't know. I didn't read those ones. And it runs a Linux derivative, 4 gig of ROM, half a gig of RAM.
Yeah, something along those lines. So some smart cookies at DEF CON's hacked it this year. And next slide, please. Cool. So the fridge talks directly to the cloud. I mean, in my personal opinion, no one's from Samsung here, right? Oh, good. I think I would rather just get a tablet and like super glue it onto my fridge. They'll do the same job, shouldn't it?
You're still like a student at heart, aren't you?
I am. I am living the poverty life. So what's the problem with it? Well, it connects to home Wi-Fi. Same with a lot of the other devices. And it also stores your Google credentials on the fridge. So what some smart cookies and DEF CON's Internet of Things Hacking Village discovered is that although SSL is being used for communicating from the fridge to other servers, they're not in fact checking the certificates, the SSL certs, which means that the communication are susceptible to a man-in-the-middle attack, which means people can actually sniff the traffic, steal your Google credentials, and then proceed to do horrible things. Let's say if you live in a bad neighborhood, they could actually steal your stuff from your fridge.
Every neighborhood in Auckland's a bad neighborhood, so watch out, yuppies. I went there. Damn it, session evaluations are gonna suck. So So we skip through, you know, there's more things. There's batteries that you can put in your smoke alarm.
Smart batteries.
That talk to your Wi-Fi network and will send you messages on your phone when your smoke alarm goes off.
So when your house is burning down, it's like, your house appears to be burning down. Please come home.
Thanks for that battery. Pity the fire was my home Wi-Fi router. And so, you know, the future is middle of the night, 2 a.m., beeping smoke alarms, and you have to go and upgrade the firmware on all of your batteries to get it to stop. I've got to show you this video. So this is a thermometer.
What makes a thermometer smart other than the fact that it can tell you if you have a temperature or not? Well, this one actually connects to a smartphone, either iOS or Android, and when it does, you can actually take your temperature, log those readings, and in addition, tap on icons that tell you if you have symptoms or not. Now, to get it to work, you actually plug the thermometer into the headphone jack on your phone. One end is that standard connector for a headphone jack. The other end is the probe that actually takes your temperature, and it can take the temperature orally under the arm or by placing it into the rectum.
Now, I really recommend that you sort out which of the options you're going to use and stick with it consistently. And make sure you tell your child which option that you're using.
Oh, goodness.
And how scary is it that this app is collecting all the information about your psychoses and how you think you might have the flu that could be later used against you in insurance claims, or your employer could get access to this in the future and maybe not hire you, or
the internet of
you
me.
Know, find out that you've got some diseases or whatever due to rectal oral conditions. I can't believe I said rectal.
I can't believe either, Craig.
Oh, well. I'm the butt of all jokes. Okay. One that you can actually buy in Wellington, the Mitsubishi Electric
heat pump.
Yep. Just so that you can turn it on when you're away from home. And they have some really good marketing around it.
Like, for example. Too soon?
Yeah. Hands up if you were in it. No, just kidding. Okay, so we've got time for Felix to do a quick demo.
Yep.
So we're going to...
We are going to switch to my screen. Let's switch to... Let's switch to your screen first.
Okay.
Yep.
So this is just with that SD card. So when I plug it into my Mac, it's going to turn on the wireless. So is that showing up yet? flashier_blah. And there should be an SD card sitting on my Mac. It doesn't have any data in it yet. There's a few hidden directories there, which might come in useful later. Normally, the user wouldn't see those. You ready for it now?
Not yet. Give me one moment.
Too late.
Ah. Well, it doesn't do anything right now. Give me one moment.
Why is there no video?
Send some traffic through it.
Oh, so you want me to log in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Log in and there we go.
Okay, so Flash Air, I need to connect to that network. I'm going to regret this. Never connect to one of Felix's networks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Well,
don't join to that network. I don't know if my flash card can handle it. Come on, DNS.
Join the network. Chug, 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 yep. I will switch to my screen now.
Oh, so there's the web user interface.
Yep.
Because I was the first person to use this card, I have some administration settings that only I can see, and it decides that by looking at my MAC address, because I was the first person that used it.
Yep. So switching back to my screen, let's say, assuming I am a malicious attacker, which I am not, I am just a nice person with happy feelings, I'm currently running a tool called Kismet, which allows me to see all nearby networks. So the one Kirk is running right now is called... Flash Air. And as you can see, goodness gracious, a lot of people are connecting to it.
Welcome to my network, everybody.
No, seriously, guys. Why? Why are you all connecting to this network?
Okay, I'm going to attack a Huawei TE device.
Yeah, do it. I know Kirk's running an Apple. This is a Mac. Oh,
that's why I hid it behind the Windows computer.
Oh, what? Forget I said anything. And remember earlier on in the talk I mentioned that the master code is in fact just a MAC address. So I think we're a bit concerned about time right now.
So you can see my MAC address on the screen there, 7831.
Yep.
See you.
So that's public information.
That is public information, which is actually the admin credential. So earlier on today, I wrote a quick proof of concept hack for this. Horrible, janky, last-minute code. Please don't judge me. What is code reuse anyway?
Hands up if this is the first Linux / Python talk you've seen so far at TechEd. Don't put that on your session eval either. We might not get invited back.
I'll keep that in mind. Yep. So it attempts to connect to FlashAir, which is the web server. It sees if it can connect to it. If it can, it will attempt to access, type in the master code, which is Kirk's IP address, which...
MAC address.
MAC address, sorry. Happens to be something 7831, whatever. And once I've gained, access to the administrator panels, I will check, can I upload files to the SD card? Yes or no. By default, the file upload functionality is disabled. But thankfully enough, you can actually enable it remotely.
Right. Yeah, so we downloaded the firmware and gripped through it looking for useful options that weren't documented.
Yep. So apparently option 118 is to check if upload is enabled. If not, you can actually just set upload to 1. Yep. And
Then that secret directory called SDWLAN
yep,
that no one can normally see, that contains config files for the computer that's sitting next to the SD card. And what it does is on boot, it will copy stuff out of that config directory into the computer part. And so probably writing to that is a bad idea.
Probably writing to your config directory is not a good idea.
Foreshadowing, dun dun dun.
So let's try this. So what do we have here? We've got a file here called, that's the content of the file. Hello, MS Ignite. I sure hope
to read it.
Come on, let me have my fun. And I'm about to run my proof of concept script with Kirk's MAC address. Yep. Let's give it a shot. Back to you, Kirk.
Okay, so.
It should be good to go.
Oh, I was naughty.
Have you been
that
naughty?
That card out without disconnecting it. Switch back to, my Apple's going to tell me off now, isn't it? So let's see if there's a file in that directory called list.htm. Oh, there is. That's naughty. There's the config file next to it. That's the one that you put your Wi-Fi credentials into. Now when you go to the browser, sorry, I have to connect. It's so weird having to connect your computer to an SD card using Wi-Fi.
That is really strange.
Now the SD card's running a website with Felix's file on it. Everyone connect to our new website. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
Social and stuff.
Exactly.
Website running on an SD card. Bizarre. Cool. So we're going to zip through what you can actually do about this. This is the bit where we tell you why everything sucks and you're going to make it better.
All of you.
So how do you actually secure the Internet of Hackable Things?
Well, when you look at it, I mean, the Internet of Things is not that different. We're putting the Internet in Internet of Hackable Things. There's servers, there's web apps, there's storage, just like any other web accessing app, isn't it?
But however, it is kind of different. Writing embedded software is actually hard. Like, if you're a web developer, you probably haven't had to deal with memory management. You know, I've been using the .NET framework since the early 2000s. I haven't written C++ since university. Let's just assume that's true. Hmm. Haven't done it for work since university. There's different communication protocols. You have to make trade-offs. The devices have constraints. You know, like maybe encrypting stuff is too slow for the little device you want to ship in your light bulb.
And also not to mention that you simply cannot just push a new version to production on like web apps. For example, you can't just push something to this teddy. Seriously, I'd love to see you try without a scalpel and some fancy firmware.
Please don't break my teddy. So rolling out updates, it's like the home routers. You know, these internet devices, it's a battery sitting in a smoke alarm. There is no way you can update that software after you've written it. Whereas with a web server, you just have to ask your users to refresh the web page, and they get the new software.
And there's also real-life consequences, for example. Car brakes. I mean, it's a matter of life and death in that matter.
Ashley Madison, matter of life and death. Ooh, actually. No, that's actually true.
Too soon.
So things you can do. So we had a buggy web app. You've been to talks, hopefully, about securing web apps. There might be one tomorrow that's useful to you as well. Follow the common security practices when you're building your web apps, and don't be like the teddy bear web server.
Please don't.
Require strong passwords. Don't let people enter bad passwords for their devices, and certainly let them change it.
And make it easy for them to change it as well. Often, a lot of administrative passwords are hidden behind layers and layers of panels and prompts, and people can't find them, so they'll never change them.
I think most people never change their wireless password, do they? Don't put your communication visibly over the wire, so the bulbs talking in plain text, or the Jeep CAN bus, or the Metromail receiving SMS. Encrypt your traffic between your device and anything else.
And when you're encrypting your traffic, just make sure you're actually using a good, say, Cypher suite, and actually up-to-date TLS. And just follow the general good practice.
Close the ports. So this one here I was saying was quite good. There was no open ports on the device to attack. But some of the other things that have been looked at, like the gun had Wi-Fi open, the SD card had UDP 53 and TCP 80. Make sure that you validate any SSL certificates that you receive. So that normally means you need to pin it, because the device can't really download new root certificates. So you need to pin it to the root that you're going to use on your server. It's a bit of a pain.
Certainly is. And generally, mobile bugs, ensure that your data is actually stored in a secure manner. Let's say if you're actually writing an iPhone app, put in the keychain. Make sure it's encrypted. Don't store anything sensitive credentials in plain text.
Don't stick dumbass default credentials on every device. Use something that's, like a sticker on the back of the box seems to be the current approach. Or make the device unusable until the first password is set, and make sure the users set that themselves. And when you're actually writing the code, don't write buggy code. So we've talked about all these things before, but when you're updating your Internet of Things device, make sure people can't push their own updates to it, like they did with the Jeep, and send their own head unit code to it.
And since a lot of the Internet of Things runs on either ARM or, say, ARM architecture, just make sure you actually have a good understanding of memory safety, for example, stack smashing or buffer overflow, string formatting bugs, just to make sure that people can't actually gain shell on your teddy bear.
Cool, and remember that anything you ship as a physical device is tamperable, and it doesn't really matter what you put in the terms and conditions. People are going to open it up and poke inside. So prepare for that. Don't rely on obscurity with an encryption between your light bulbs, for example. Actually, think about that as a risk and cater for it. And if you've got device secrets on those devices, be double sensitive with those.
And privacy concerns. A lot of the Internet of Things devices live in a bedroom, like the teddy bear or the sleep sensor. So consider the possible privacy implications it might have with it. A few years ago, there was a sports watch where they actually, what did they measure again? What was it?
I don't do sports.
Okay, I think I actually measured something about sexual activities and published it online by default.
Oh.
Yeah, and it wasn't very pretty. So, and that brings us to the next point. Creepy. Yeah. Don't be creepy.
Consider doing a threat model. Here's one I did of that insurance dongle. If you use a threat modeling tool, it'll spit out a bunch of threats based on boundaries that the communication's crossing and data flows. Look at the Internet of Things top 10 on OWASP. It's a bit new and a bit weak, but it points into some other useful information. Follow us. Listen to Risky Business, which is an awesome podcast that's on weekly. It's run by
an Australian.
But don't hold that against him. Pat's a really cool guy. And if you're interested in this kind of security stuff, there's a whole day on it in 2016. I think it'll be around February, called OWASP Day, that's in Auckland. Cool, so that's kind of been us, the Internet of Hackable Things. There is a whole bunch of other Internet of Things topics on, as well as some security topics. I have a particular fondness for the 10:40 a.m. session tomorrow.
Here, even.
I think I'll be attending.
Me too.
And in that session, you'll get to look at some of the considerations that big companies like FaceSpace and MyBook would look at when they're building their social networks, and how they secure those capabilities. Cool. So in the nick of time, I think,
That draws us to an end. I'd like to thank Andy Prowl for his contribution to this talk.
Thanks, Andy.
And this has been Kirk and Felix. Thank you very much.
Cheers, guys.